This is a very nice little recorder. It picks up just your normal voice without a bit of trouble. Is your official title retired graduate research professor?
Well, President Emeritus.
President Emeritus.
When I was to Florida.
All right, that's fine. This is an oral history interview, and today is October the 8th, 1974. We're in the Florida State Museum on the campus of the University of Florida. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Stephan. Is it Stephan or Stephen?
Stephan.
P-A-N. S-T-E-P-H-A-N-P, and it's Sashoff. S-A-S-H-O-F-F, Professor Emeritus here in the University of Florida. His background in electrical engineering. Dr. Sashoff, let's begin with some very basic information. You were born where and when, sir? And let's talk just for a minute or two about your childhood, perhaps, maybe some interesting aspects before you came to the United States. I know you were born in Bulgaria.
Well, I was born in Bulgaria in a very small little town. At that time, probably a population of 2,000, Drenovo, D-R-E-N-O-V-O.
Whereabouts is that now?
This is in the northern slope of the Balkan Mountains, about halfway from the Yugoslav border to the Black Sea.
Have you ever been back there?
Oh, yes.
Many times.
Yes. After I came to the university and during the Depression, of course, we only were on a 9-month basis. So I found out that since my parents, I had sent my parents back to visit and they decided they wanted to stay, and I found it cheaper to go and spend the summer traveling in Europe than stay here. And so I visited every year practically from 1933 until 1938.
Oh, I see. So you've been back many times.
When I married, and then in 1939, I and my wife, I took her to see the whole place, and we had a very interesting time.
I can imagine.
Hitler was ready to march into Czechoslovakia, and I didn't know whether the thing was going to blow up in our faces, and we were very happy to get aboard the ship and get out of the English Channel and be on our way. So I have been back numerous times, and going back, I also, of course, I traveled all over Europe, including the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And the last trip was in summer 1960.
I see. Well, you've been back many times then, so forth. Many changes in that area, I guess?
Oh, yes. The changes have been tremendous, particularly in Eastern Europe. Of course, that's true all over, but particularly there, where they were starting practically from scratch.
Following the war, you mean?
Oh, yes, following the war. I'm talking about 1963.
Right.
Up to the beginning of World War II, things were pretty much the same. There, cities have grown larger.
You were born in 1901. Of course, you would remember the First World War. Do you recall any particular experiences? Did you have to move, or did the war touch your area to any extent?
Well, of course. I was still in just finishing junior high.
Mm-hmm.
In junior high over there in the European system, there is a public school or grammar school, 4 years, junior high 3 years, and then senior high 5 years. So the same 12 years that we have in this country, but the divisions were a little different, and the curriculums, of course, are quite different. For example, just studying foreign languages in the fifth grade here, or the first year in junior high. And of course, we were centering on five major areas. And you particular grading. In the grading system, you're graded in this particular area. So that's where I was, and the board had started. My father was over here. He had come over here in 1907 to make his fortune.
Oh, I see. He was already over.
In order to save $1,000 fortune and pay his passage, of course, both ways. Well, poor guy, he never could make it. But anyway, when the war started, they can come back, and we were trapped, so to speak, my mother and I. We had some savings, not not too much, but some to keep us going for a while, because pretty soon the savings ran out. And I was just finishing junior high. And of course, there was no practically no chance of me going to high school because of the fact that this little town did not have a high school. It just went to the junior high, which will be, of course, the seventh grade here. The nearest high schools were, well, in those days, great distance, 24 kilometers or something like 60 miles, whatever it is. And so, but there was no chance. I mean, we had to go over there and rent a room and, you know, that sort of thing. As luck would have it, I was really very depressed. And for a while, I was on the verge, and probably it would have happened, I would have gone to the theological seminary, which was tuition-free, board room-free, in other words, you're taken care of. But fortunately, my brother, who was just 3 years older than I, came home one day and told mother that everything is fine. I got a job in a bakery, and now we're going to bake hardtack for the army. So then he said he had been high school in this other town, and he said if he can go over and to my old landlord, and I'm sure he'll take him, and then we'll square with him eventually. So I did, and of course after a while he was drafted and went to war. Then my mother came over, and bless her heart, she was really something. She wanted me to get an education. She managed to get a job in cleaning railway porches.
You said she came over now. Was she, did she go to the United States with your father?
No, she was over there.
She was over there.
She was over there. Well, anyway, that and I worked part-time as a cobbler, shoemaker, while I was going to school, and then occasionally I would tutor, and that's where I acquired this desire to teach, which eventually brought me here.
Did you have an interest in science at this age?
Yes, particularly in making. Of course, we were limited as far as library facilities or things like that in school. And in most courses, we had no textbooks, which maybe was a good thing. We had to take notes and then, of course, transcribe them, and they became our books. Be as it may, I was just graduating from high school and top of my class when the war ended. The mails opened, my dad sent some money. He was on the verge of coming home. They discovered that when the demobilization started taking place, my brother did not come back.
Missing in action.
Well, for a while it was that way. What happened is that now that we had a little bit of money, I just went on to the capital, Sofia, and to the war ministry, and tried to get to the records of his regiment, which had been disbanded. It's one of those regiments that was formed just for the war. And they told me that they did not have the records available. They are not here. They are in another town somewhere from this little distance, not too far from the capital. So I went there and went through the records, and we can hardly find anything. But finally, we located this small piece of paper torn from a page in which stated that he had gotten killed the day before the armistice, and was buried there on the battlefield somewhere in Macedonia. Well, but this is relates to the rest of the story is simply this, that my brother was gone. My father had very unfortunate experience. He had managed to save, in the meantime, about $3,000, and I was ready to come home. I was finishing high school, and somebody advised them not to haul their money, but to change it immediately into Bulgarian currency, because the rate had gone from 5 to the dollar to 23 to the dollar. Well, that was fine. But they changed the money, not payable in the current rate of exchange and delivery of the check, but at that particular rate. Well, by the time the check came, the rate has gone to 89 to the dollar. So the $3,000 shrank to something less than $1,000. Well, my mother wanted me to go to college. She wanted to study medicine. I love medicine, but I could never be a doctor. I understood, because I'm very emotional, and I can't take it to see people suffer. And of course, if you're a doctor, you have to face that. You have to face death quite often. And so I made up my mind for the election.
How old were you now?
I was 19.
19.
Now, there was no technical school in Bulgaria at the time. So that meant I either had to go to Germany or to France, which is quite expensive. And when I wrote my father, he said, well, it doesn't make sense. We can't send you to school abroad unless I stay here. I here, you somewhere else, your mother back home. Why don't you take whatever is left of the money I sent and come over to this country, to America? So that's what we did. Third class.
Was there much trouble getting a visa right after the war? It seemed like there have been so many persons.
No, fortunately, you see, I was just on the verge, for military service. But because of the war and the aftermath, the question was sort of a moot, and so I had no difficulty getting a passport, and so my mother and I then came over and joined my father in Indianapolis, Indiana. And
quite a change.
Well, there's a greater change, and this is about my family, really. When my father came to this country, he worked for 50 cents a day.
This was in 1907.
Yeah. When we came in February 1921, he was making a grand amount of $60 a month as a meat cutter at the Kingdom and Company plant in the United States. And then I don't know where we ever got the courage, or whatever it is, for me to go to college.
He must have been extremely frugal, because to have saved $3,000 from 1907 to 1920 something,
Well, of course, that is another story that is not often told. The way they did it, 8 men rented a room with 4 double beds. Mm-hmm. And then they had an arrangement with the company, with the meat company, where they could take off a day or a week, so often. So they rotated.
Awesome.
And the man who didn't work did the cooking for them and the cleaning, whatever. And that was the only way how to save any money any other way. Mm-hmm. But even in those days, you know, these things were pretty rigid. And anyway, we contacted some other Bulgarians, and one of them, who was a wholesale grocer, had also gotten interested in helping the incoming immigrants. And he had worked a correspondence course in English. And so I started taking that, and there's a one way of learning. The other way, you go to the movies.
Yeah.
They're all silent movies, of course, in those days. They were a nickel or a dime, whatever the thing was. And of course, I tried to relate what I studied and the action and the subtitles. And I've told this story so many times, it's funny, but I think it was my second year in college I discovered that it did not spell fellow, F-E-L-L-E-R. It is not a fellow, it is a fellow, see? But that's the way I had learned it from the dime movies. Well, anyway, we talked to these folks, and one of the men working for this company said, well, I'll go with you. When you're ready to go to college in order to find out what your credentials are in order, a diploma and so forth. So in the meantime, before I left Bulgaria, I had it translated into English by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Department of State over here, of course, and then certified by the Bulgarian the American legation there. There was no embassy then. There is no embassy now. In other words, this is a legation, is a grade below an embassy level. So I had the documents. Anyway, so said, well, where are you going to go? I said, well, go to the State University. What's the State University? It's just State University in Western Indiana. And I'm ready to go to Bloomington to inquire about my taking electrical engineering, when somebody said, well, you can't go, there's no point of going there, there's no engineering in the Indiana University. Well, where is the school? They said, the State Engineering School at Purdue, at Lafayette. So, okay, now, that's interesting, because they could have said, why don't you go to Notre Dame, Valparaiso, the Tri-State, or any of the other schools, but they say Purdue, so we went to Purdue, and we talked to the registrar. They're very nice people, of course. I could hardly speak any English. I could read and understand like that, but you see, this was in June. I had just come here in February, and without any intensive studying in English, I was very, very poor. Well, anyway, somewhere in the register office said, now, are you sure they want to go to school here? And this man was with us translating. He says, why? He says, well, he could go to the University of Illinois and get credit for the freshman and sophomore year. And so he asked, well, how? He said, well, the European educational system, the high schools are so advanced that what usually normally take in this country in the freshman and sophomore year, except for English, composition, is already had. Well, that was quite a bit out of the question. So I said, well, can I get some credits over here? And they say, yes, but you have to take examination for advanced standing. Well, how could I? Mm-hmm. I couldn't speak English.
Right.
So he said, well, we'll just take it the way it is. So I made the application and advised me when the school opened. And I went out there, and fortunately, there was no hitch. The registration was very simple. Before I got there, they had all my courses on a printed card, my section print, you know, punched in, everything was all set. The only thing was to find a place to stay. When we were there earlier, the registrar said, well, he may have a little difficulty when he gets here, so why don't you go over and talk to the folks or the YMCA? So we did. I said, well, when he comes in September, why, let him come here and we'll help him out. They've helped me, but what they gave me, a box with a card index with rooms to rent. So it was all right. So I started around, and I remember I came to this very nice family, but the lady said, well, yes, it'll be very fine, but have you got a roommate? Well, I didn't even know what a roommate was. But I had learned that if you don't understand, say no, you're probably safer that way. So I said, no, I don't have a roommate. I was not lying, really, but that was the truth. So anyway, fortunately, in the third try, I found a room with this very old, delightful family. I didn't know that was their family home, mansion, or whether they had bought it later, I don't know, but they were renting quite a few rooms in the house to students. They took me in, and they helped me a lot. And after I'd been there all about a month or 6 weeks, the landlady, bless her heart, said, Steve, she said, we love to have you here, but I think you need some help. You need to be around somewhere where people will be talking to you more and helping you with your English. And I'll tell you what, I'll call up down at the Cosmopolitan Club and see if somebody will meet you there if you just go down and talk to them. This was just a few blocks from where their home.
Right.
The Cosmopolitan Club is an interesting organization. It was a fraternity. Did you ever hear of it?
No, sir. I have. There's an international club type organization.
Yes. And at one time, I believe, it had as many chapters as any other fraternity, if not more. 59 chapters in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the rule was that they'd take 60% American kids, and the other 40% will be made as great variety as students from other lands. So the landlady urged me, and I then moved there, and that helped in more than one way, because in the first place I got part-time employment waiting at tables in the fraternity house, and also in the winter, that's for my meals, in the winter, then I could buy the furnace for my rent too. So we made out all right. So in the combination, I said we've been very, very fortunate, and I personally, of course, have always been, and always will be forever thankful for the chance I got, because I don't know what would happen if we had come over here. Life goes on. made out some way, but I got the opportunity to do a particular thing that I eventually wanted to do in that speech.
So you graduated from Purdue in 1925.
25.
Electrical engineering degree.
And I graduated in the top 5 percentile on the, in the class. So in our scheme of things, it'll be about 95th, is that right? They count from,
right.
From the bottom. Well, this helped. In the meantime, of course, I had picked up English. I still have an accent. It gets worse when we got excited. But anyway, we graduated at a time when it was a seller's market. Everybody was looking for college graduates, particularly in engineering. So I had 5 offers. Jobs, but one of the people that came to interview us, Mr. Cope, COPE, who was a Purdue graduate, but had become director of engineering for the Westinghouse Electric Manufacturing Company, and he had such an interest in the school that he himself came over to interview the prospective students. Anyway, he told me on the idea, or whatever it was, made a good impression on me, so I took the job with Westinghouse, and I went on there. They called it, at that time, the Graduate Engineer Training Program. It was not, in that sense, the graduate meant that you had graduated with a bachelor's degree from the university. So I started in August. I had taken a little vacation in the summer, started in August. And that year, Westinghouse took 400 student graduates, engineers, and split us in 2 groups. One group to go into sales, about 200, and the other group, 200, to go into the technical side. In engineering. So I was in the second group, and then they separated us in smaller groups, and for the remaining 6 months, we were on this so-called training program. This involved, if you were on the first group, you simply went to school at a company plant, where the pressure was to have in college, plus special things about the company, the emphasis on their products. The other 3 months was spent going from one department to another and observing. In some places, they won't let us try to do something, and that was pitiful. They were assembling electric motors, with the girls putting the windings on the starter parts, and they are nimble and go on and go. They put the wiring is already preformed, but it's got to be put in the slots and anchored there, and also placed in the proper order. And when they get through, the thing is neat as a pin. By the time we got through it, we didn't have enough slots to put the wire size in. Well, anyway, I went to their engineering school, which was the 3 months. Then I went in this various departments, and then I was selected as one of 16 to go in their design school for 6 months.
This was the top school, I guess, at Westinghouse.
Yeah. At the Westinghouse. But fortunately also, Westinghouse had made an arrangement. They had made an arrangement with the University of Pittsburgh that because certain of the instruction was equal to or maybe superior to some of the courses taught at the university, that the university gave credit. It's a sort of a cooperative program now. even over here, I think we still give in our summer students some credit for what they call practical experience. But this was not that. This was still high level technical academic training. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, that of course started me in my graduate work. Mm-hmm. With this many credits to begin with, I think we all accumulated between the engineering and design school, accumulated something like 12 credits. And then I started going to night school, night class at Gimbel University of Pittsburgh, which went with my master's degree, and then I continued again towards the doctorate and accumulated altogether of 72 credits, which is incredible now because we grant the doctorate now as little as 40. You know, we give credit for the dissertation at that time. Well, anyway, as it may, it was a very fine experience, but I never did get to start my dissertation. Incidentally, my more advanced work was done in a very unusual manner. I was the only student in the class. I wanted to take certain course, series of courses, and this particular professor, I had to go and have a conference with him, and if he agreed, then I was allowed to register to that particular course. And even in those days, the tuition was $10 per credit.
Getting rather steep.
Steep for those days. And no scholarships, no assistantship, no nothing. Anyway, I did that. And then just I was finishing my work, coursework, then I applied for a Westinghouse fellowship. Westinghouse has these fellowships. And you had a choice. You could go to school in this country, you could go to school abroad. Fine, except we're hit by the Depression. You see, that was 1900 and going to 1931, late 1930. Well, Westinghouse start cutting. Everybody start cutting. So they cut all the fellowships. In the meantime, I had even began looking after the subject for dissertation because I was sure I was going to go to Technische Hochschule in Berlin. Well, that was it. Anyway, be it as it may, then Depression was on, and not only was when I did this, and all the other companies, people getting fired right and left. Mm-hmm. And while this was going on, I received a telegram from Dr. Zworykin, who is the father of modern television as far as we know it.
How's the spelling on that, sir?
Z-W-O-R-Y. K-K-I-N, whoever he can. And the reason he knew me, because he had left Russia just after the revolution, or during the revolution, and his family, white Russians, had moved to Paris, and he went to school there. And he got the idea for this television system there. And then immigrated to this country and was working at the Westinghouse research. And I had transferred from my original department to research. And I was making certain vacuum tubes or electronic tubes for him, for his system. So I knew him. As a matter of fact, his lab was just a couple of doors down from mine. And what had happened is that General Electric, Westinghouse, and Victor Phonograph Company had agreed to combine to form RCA. Victor is to provide the physical facilities, the plant in Camden, New Jersey, and General Electric and Westinghouse to transfer their technical staff and radio, and in those days, of course, that also included the work that Dworkin was doing, and also I think that General Electric was doing some television work that's connected it. Well, anyway, so Dr. Dworkin and his group, and most of the rest of my group in research in electronics had moved to Camden. But I stayed behind because of Westinghouse research, because of the fact that I was in what was known as industrial application, which is not part of the agreement. Well, anyway, I received this telegram from Dr. Dworkin asking me if I'll be interested to go and work with him in Camden. Boy, was I interested. And so was the department, the research department, because everybody in administration were frantically trying to find places for the folks that we had to be left out. They had to be left out. They let out 60% of the staff, and the remaining 40% were put on 2 days a week for 2 days' pay. Of course, the pay also was cut later on. So I went to Dr. Dworkin and worked on the picture tubes. That
must have been quite an honor for you. I'm sure your parents were very proud of you by this time.
Yes, they were, and my mother, bless her heart, it was a great reward for her because she had really worked like a dog to put me through high school. My parents had moved to Pittsburgh when I got the job there. But when I went to RCA, they remained in Pittsburgh.
Well, what type of person was this? What is his name? Sorokin?
Dworkin.
Dworkin. Like, was he an immigrant, I take it, also? And you said after the Revolution, he went to Paris, and then he came to the States, and was at the, was it Westinghouse there?
Yeah, it was Westinghouse.
And he started there. This gave him opportunity to develop the theory that he had thought
of. Well, yes, of course, he was, he was quite an inventor, quite a scientist. Even after he came, he then went to the University of Pittsburgh, and I think got his doctorate at the University of Pittsburgh. Apparently, he did not finish the Sorbonne or wherever he was studying in Paris. There I was now in Camden, New Jersey, working for RCA, but the economic picture was getting worse by the minute, and I probably might have weathered the storm, I don't know. But one day I received this letter forwarded by my father, who's still in Pittsburgh, written to me by a man who was the father confessor, advisor, and what, of all the young engineers that came into Westinghouse. Mr. A.M. Dudley. And this letter addressed to me, my home in Pittsburgh. He couldn't locate me in the company because I had already left. So in the letter he said, Mr. Sarshoff, I know that you'd be interested in going into teaching. And indeed I had. I had applied at Brookman Polytechnic, and they wanted me. And I also applied to the George Washington University St. Louis. They wanted me. But in each of those places, they wanted me as an instructor at $1,500 a month.
A year.
$1,500 a year. Mm-hmm. But you see, I was making $3,200. And I could not, obviously, you know, cut my standard of living or whatever you want to call it. I just couldn't take that much of a loss.
A bit over half.
Yeah. But Mr. Dudley wrote that he received a letter from the Dean of the College of Engineering at the University of Florida. They're looking for a man with an electronic background, and if you're interested, contact him and see what happens. Well, I received the letter. I look at the calendar, and there we go. This is wonderful, but incidentally, he also said that the salary, the rank will be assistant professor, and the salary will be $2,300. Well, to begin with, this represents a cut. But you see, it's for 9 months, not for 12.
Much better than the 1,500.
So much the 1,500 for even for 9 months, you see, it's a quite a big difference. Well, anyway, I look at the calendar and I said, well, sure, this was early, you know, almost the second, going into almost second week in September. I said, sure, they must have filled the position by now. But so, yeah. So after work, I walked down to the Western Union and sent a nice letter, 50 words, applying for the job, saying that a letter with my more complete biographical sketch had been forwarded. Next day, I got a telegram, you hired.
Who was this now, one that you were dealing with?
The dean was Dean Van Leer. He had just come here.
Van Leer?
Van Leer, you call the name. But I was dealing eventually with Professor Weil, who later became dean after Dean Van Leer left. Anyway, they say, you accepted, you have the job, the registrar is sending the university catalog. Well, I waited for the catalog. It was getting pretty late. So it's getting into the third week in September. So I fired a wire. I did not get the catalog when the school started. Well, I came right back. School started today. Report as soon as you can.
I imagine your family was rather topsy-turvy about now, trying to get everything settled, trying to just, never had been to Florida. I know you probably were wondering what you were doing.
They did not
into.
Come.
I see.
It couldn't. Couldn't under that short notice. But the whole business was that I'll come on down and get settled and find a place to stay, and then they'll come down. Well, anyway, are you interested in this much detail all the time?
Oh, it's fine.
Huh? Anyway, I had to sit down, and for 2 days I dictated to a secretary everything that's in my head that really belonged to RCA.
I see.
And then I left, went back to Pittsburgh, and picked up something, and came to Gainesville on the train, and of course the train ran right down the middle of Main Street. And
what about RCA now? Were they very upset with you, or did they say more power to you?
No.
Good luck,
no. Westinghouse not upset when I left, and although Doc was working, probably was a little bit unhappy I was leaving, but. On the other hand, he has also been relieved. You see, they
no
didn't
jobs.
Know whether the whole thing is going to fold up. Mm-hmm. After all, RCA stock was selling for 25 cents a share, and I wish I had bought a couple of $100.
I guess so.
Because, Lord Almighty, the physical assets of the company, building, machinery, and so on, was worth at least $5 to $10 a share anyway, mm-hmm. no matter what happened. See, mm-hmm. just like having a piece of land. I mean, I don't care what it's selling for, the land is there. It's right. it's always be worth something. Well, anyway, I arrived in Gainesville, got off the train, looked around for a cab. In the meantime, Pullman, I had the Pullman, if you had the directories of hotels and so forth, I looked up and said, well, this looks like a pretty good hotel, White House. Sounds like Washington, D.C. So I got on the train looking for a cab and asked the fellow, I said, where can I get a cab? And he said, well, there's only one jitney around here, but he must have gone. Where do you want to go? And I said, I want to go to White House Hotel. He started laughing. I said, what you laughing for? He said, right across the street.
Yeah.
So that was my...
This was in September of 32 now. Is that right? Okay, so we can pick up. General, you just arrived in Gainesville now. It's September of 32. And...
I don't know the exact day, because
they're on the 23rd, 22nd of September, 1932. And so here I was, and
what was your impression on the campus first time? You rather provincial-looking little town, of course.
Well, I had, you know, grown up in a very small town, and of course I went to school at Lovelace, Indiana, which is not a very big town. Anyway, this was a university town. Purdue had been roaming of 2,300 when I was there, so the town was very large. Mm-hmm. So there is no great difference to observe or to be impressed too much by a small town. The great impression, of course, is people who are friendly. First of all, Miss Wild, of course, was no member in the faculty, they started looking after me, and I started looking out for a place to stay. I was still at the hotel first for a couple of days, it wasn't a good place to stay, and then finally got a room at the home of Mr. Klein Graham. Did that make ring bell?
Oh, yeah.
He was the business manager of the university. I don't know whether they're going to save that house for, you know, historical purpose or not. It's a rather unusual house. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, so I got a room there, and it was very, very satisfactory. Actually, it was an apartment. I had a living room, which was the most famous. This one here, I think it was the original library of the house, and a large bedroom and a shower bathroom connected to it. So things were just very, very, very friendly. As far as the campus is concerned, I believe enrollment was around 21. Thereabouts. There were no page, well, I'll take it back. There was only one so-called page street. And what is that time known as the Ellipse. And it started at, 19 University, now 13 University, where the university sign is there.
Right.
And it runs in a curve by the old Low College building.
Right.
And on by the science hall, mm-hmm. and I don't know if that was finished all the way, but that part was paved with a very thin layer of asphalt. The rest of the campus had no paving. They were just beginning to pave a couple of the
the street, the roads, when I arrived. As a matter of fact, the campus, the streets were in a mess because they had him all back up to the construction job.
Where was electrical engineering situated in those days?
Well, the electrical engineering was in what was known as the New Engineering Building. It is now part of Walker Hall, I think. You know, the Walker, they changed the name to Walker Auditorium. Did they change to Carlton Auditorium?
I don't know. The Carlton is the one by Little Hall.
Yeah.
William Carlton.
Yeah, but I mean, this is just the auditorium.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it used to be the Walker Hall, or part of it, and next to it is old building, which was the new engineering building, and the reason it was new, because the College of Engineering had started in Benton Hall, which is now gone, because the College of Engineering consisted at the beginning with only one man who is also a professor of physics. Dean Benton.
Yes.
Anyway, they had built this new building, this building, which was the called the New Engineering Building, like the new gymnasium. you know the story about new gymnasium.
Right.
That's where our classrooms were, and where the Professor Wiles, Dr. Dinoff. But our laboratory was in Benton Hall.
What type of setup did you have now? I imagine the laboratory facilities were rather sparse and so forth.
Of course, you see, we're just entering into the electronic age or era, if you want to. So, actually, what the laboratory consisted of was power equipment, motors, generators, that sort of thing. It was very well equipped and very well put together for the size of the school and the department. Excellent. And Professor Weil was the head of the department, and he had only one professor with him, and Professor E.F. Smith, who I think will retire next year. I thought he retired in this year. Professor Smith had been here, I think, 50 years, man or boy. Well, anyway, that was it. And I arrived, so that was the department. But as soon as I arrived, Professor Weil quit teaching. Actually, he did teach one course on industrial management or something of the fact, but it was not a technical course. So the teaching, actually, the line faculty consisted of Professor Smith and myself, the assistant professor and other assistant professor. And that was it. So he handled all the power courses, and I picked up all what they call the circuit courses, and then we started developing the electronic curriculum, which was quite an experience, because we wanted, I wanted, and Chris Weil wanted, that we have an electronic option.
As part of the curriculum.
The curriculum. Mm-hmm. But the mechanical engineering department won't let us. You see, it's still the other way. You cannot offer a course unless it's approved by the department, by the college, eventually by the University Curriculum Committee. But we are outnumbered, you see. we are two, eventually three of us, and the other 15 are in mechanical engineering. There were no, well, I'll take it back. There were two in chemical engineering. But that was it. But eventually we managed to bluster and bluff and so on to establish the electronic option, and we start from there. But you see, I carry all the circuit courses, all the electronic courses, and Professor Smith carried all the power courses. And he also handled, well, we didn't have that many options, not options, but special courses for the other departments, as a matter of fact. The civils and mechanicals, they all took the same beginning course in electrical engineering as the electricals. I was teaching 23 semester hours and 32 contact hours.
Quite a load.
And looking back at it, and I had laughed at some of my younger colleagues in the last few years, they always complained, oh, it is a terrible one. I have teach 12 hours. And I said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I had 23 semester hours and 32 contact hours, and some of them thought to almost call me a liar. I said, don't do that. They're the catalogs. I even have them right in here. Look at them. Look at the curriculum, look at the courses, look at the teacher and see what's going on. But anyway, I had a wonderful time, really. I was single, and the other redeeming feature, of course, was that we had very few students. We were graduating on average between 10 and 14 a year in electrical engineering. And of course, the other thing that's very nice is that I go to this class here and I see 10 people, and I go to the next class and I see the same test. Yeah. See?
Yeah.
So it was about Dr. Elliott and his student on the other side of the log, you see. So there's the question of where I left off and where I continue, or whether I had touched this one, or has it been covered somewhere else? It was all there. And that was, besides that, I had a wonderful time. Whenever I had a little hour or two or whatever, I just walk across the street over there in the library and read Foreign Affairs. I was always interested in Nation and New Republic and Commonweal and L'Illustration. I don't know who's, I think for a while it's a guy for the French magazine L'On Électrique, Electric Waves, you know, the radio was coming on. So I had a wonderful time, and then the year after I came, which is 1933, I don't remember whether the one started in 32 after I came or in 33. I think we started it, but we didn't have it approved by the graduate school, offering the master's degree in electrical engineering.
I was going to ask, when did the graduate degree get started there?
And our first master's degree in electrical engineering was John W. Wilson, who at the time, when he was taking his graduate work under me, he was also the campus electrician. And he was the only one. I mean, when I say electrician, I don't mean one of our crew. That was it. Which should indicate how small in general the campus was. And of course, we had only one policeman, and they call him Hawkshaw. And so it was a very, very tightly knit institution, and I think we did very well.
Where do you see the big growth in the electrical engineering, right after the Second World War, perhaps?
The big enrollment?
Well, the enrollment, but also the development of the faculty, the expansion of the faculty.
Well, it came into the
Second World War.
Yes.
That's when things really began to boom.
When the war came, this was Sarshoff and Smith, at that time, got to be an associate professor.
Dean Wilde. Dean Wilde?
Yeah, Dean Wilde became dean after Dean Bombay left. And then my man left because he got into great arguments with the administration about what the engineering students should take in the first few years.
This is the University College episode.
Yeah, University College. The Dr. Tyler, you know, was a great believer in general education, liberal education, and he thought that everybody, including engineers, should have something in literature and the arts and biology and a few of the other things.
Right.
Well, anyway, that was all right, but the rigidity, the original rigidity of the, at that time, the general, it was called the General College, was such that Dean Van Leer felt that it limited us, because it allowed us the sequencing of courses. In other words, it's difficult for us to start in the third year and sequence anything in just four semesters. So he left, and then, of course, Professor Wildman became dean of the college. But at the beginning of the war, that was it, and they had just hired another man who hadn't arrived. But in the meantime, we had been asked by the Army Signal Corps to provide some training in radio to the signal companies of the Dixie Division and the New England Maple Leaf Division, who are or assembled and going to their preliminary training at Camp Landing. And Dean Wild called me and said, "Steve, this is Colonel Sawyer here from the Signal Corps. He's in charge of communication training and the whole works at Camp Landing for the National Guard Division. And he wants to know if we can do something for them. Here's what he had in mind." And I said, "Why not? We'll be glad to."
So
in the meantime, because we needed more space for laboratories, and this may be of interest, we had moved to the 11th floor of the Siegel Building. Well, it was strange the way it happened. Not strange, but interesting. Meanwhile, I had gone to Dr. Tigard and asked him to give us more space. And he said, "Well, I haven't got any." I said, "By the way, I can have the 11th floor of the Siegel Building." Well, the floor of the 11th floor of the Siegel Building is the original roof. You see, when the Miss Siegel bought the building, I think for $20,000, and this, you know, the condition it was in, it was just a skeleton of the building, and gave it to the university, then the College of Architecture added the 11th floor, that's offset part.
Right.
And so when we got, I said, "Well, it's better than nothing." So we said, "Well, the floor was not flowing." So the first thing to do is to get the floor leveled off, so, and then get some partitions. Of course, there was no way, you know, they had put up the 11th story, but, you know, it wasn't plastered. So, and I always also tell this story because there we were, but I always want to work in a distance around. So I decided that we'll just go ahead and fix the elevator. Now the elevator only went to the 10th because, as I say, the 11th was non-existent original design. So, for a while, I think, inveigled Major Powell, the director of WRUF, to give him some money to some boards to put the floor. Well, from then on, the thing got to be a sort of a game between myself and Major Powell, because I'll say, Major, I'll call him, I'll say, Major, we need about $10 to get some stud and some cellotex to put some partitions. And he'll hem and haw, finally he'll say, okay, so I'll go down to Combs Lumber Company and buy $50 for it. Anyway, the floor was finished by myself and the students. We did get help from a WBA carpenter who managed to get floor level for us and put some of the studs. But anyway, there it was, and still in use. You know, the research project is still going on there. And anyway, so we told Colonel Sawyer now to
kind of
pick out the, we had moved our laboratory down there, and it was really delightful. We had one room, about two-thirds as big as this, maybe half. We call it the House of Magic. Because things were coming along that people never seen. Now, we had a television system working in there. Of course, we didn't have a scanning camera. You simply, you know, if you want to be televised, you just have to stand in front of this very hot lights or have pictures, but we transmitted from one of them to the next. This idea about the House of Magic came because General Electric used to have a traveling, and then Bell Labs used to have people travel over the country and show this new fangled invention, you see. The fluorescent paints were coming out. They had the ultraviolet light, and, you know, all of a sudden the colors would change, all that sort of thing. Then we had all kinds of things. We had a radio set here playing, and then there was a switch to change from the speaker to a flickering electronic lamp, and then a lamp that goes on the other side of the aisle or the room, picked up by another lamp, go to the photo cell, go to an amplifier, come to a speaker out there. And you go in front with your hand like this, and move your fingers, and it's your volume control. I mean, did things like this. But it was really a very interesting place. The school used to bring kids over there to look at exhibits, and we build them for the engineers' permits. But that would be fair. Instead of destroying them, we just put them in this room. Well, anyway, we had
public relations.
We had the facilities, and Colonel Sawyer was a very, very savvy man in a way. You know, I guess he was too outspoken to make a general. But anyway, he was a chicken colonel before the start of the of the war. Anyway, so he said, "What I'm doing, I'm giving a selected group intelligence and aptitude tests, and out of these, I'll pick out the quality that I sent." So he sent us a dozen, and they came in. They got up with reveille, I guess, at 6 o'clock. And had their breakfast, and the cookie got them fixed with sandwiches for lunch and paper bags, and they loaded on a truck and came over and spent the day. And so we trained them in 10 weeks.
Mainly radio.
And, well, and radio, yeah. But the reason, the urgency was because the signal companies of this National Guard divisions were made primarily, almost entirely, of telephone people, telephone linemen. Well, they can string telephones on. Yeah. And they had looked at some First World War vintage radio set, but when the Army sent them the, you know, what at that time were new modern radio equipment. They don't know what to do. Operated, let alone to you know, to repair it. So anyway, we trained these people, and incidentally, for what the color, one of the students is Mr. Watson, Watson and Elliott Insurance Agency downtown.
So I've heard of that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so we trained him, and of course, then Colonel Sawyer sent another group.
Now, this was just before the war?
Just before the war.
Yes. Before the war.
This was in the spring of 1941. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, later, when the divisions went on maneuvers, referred to the Louisiana maneuvers, because that's where they, the maneuvers could have taken place. The Dixie and the New England Division, the only two that kept in radio communication throughout the exercise, and the reason for that was that the telephone wires that the signal company strung when a tank or a heavy armored vehicle came along, it cut the wires, and that was it. The other thing is that after a while, they strung the wires so long that he's talking to one end and he can't hear him on the other end. So this kid went and built little amplifiers to stick in the middle of the circuits. And the way they did that, because they went on the maneuvers, and Colonel Sawyer had found a truck, you know, in those covered vans, and found a little gasoline-driven generator, and we fixed him a little lamp repair for some of this. So we went to war.
Things seem, of course, right up to date in those days, but when you think back on it, it was so rough and ready, you know, as far as communications. Had the walkie-talkie come out in those days yet? I think
not,
it just...
Not that they came out. They were coming out, but they were not really available. then, of course, the thing just exploded. Actually, many of the equipments were on development, but they are not available. Anyway, to finish this particular part of the story, after this experience with Camp Landing, I wrote a letter to the Signal Corps asking, telling them what they've done, and asked them if they needed help, I'll be glad to take a commission. I got a letter back from them, and he said, well, thank you very kindly. They didn't even say, well, that sounds like a good idea, or as far as the school is concerned, but thank you very much, but the only one they're giving commission now to former graduates of West Point and Annapolis.
Yeah. Still before the war.
Yeah. So be it. No, this is getting real close. I mean, it was still before the war, but the war, you know, it was a little later, but as far as we're concerned, the war was
right. American participation.
Anyway, so there it is, and good Lord Almighty. Almost not more than a week or two had gone by when I received a letter, special delivery letter from the National Research Council. Professor Sashov, will you please be kind enough to take a commission with the Armed Services? I remember the Signal Corps just told me.
Yeah.
they told me all. And he said, you can pick out either in the Navy and the Army. So
I wrote back and said, well, yes, I'll be interested to take a commission. I think I can do some good, realizing the need now for training, particularly in electronics. And, well, take the Navy. Well, good Lord, is nothing flat. I get a big, thick envelope from the commandant of the 6th Naval District from Charleston, North Carolina, and said, now, what you do is to take enclosure A to Lieutenant Junior Grade, I don't recall the name now, and the Florida Union. And let him execute this immediately. And you can take care of the rest of the papers at your convenience, but don't delay too long. Well, I went to see the Lieutenant Junior Grade. You know what he was? A doctor. He's the man to give me a medical, you see, to see if I could go and act on active duty. Well, everything is all right. He sent it in, and I guess it wasn't more than 10 days later I got another letter addressed to Lieutenant Commander Stephen P. Sasha of the United States Naval Reserve with my orders to report to the Naval Air Station Jacksonville, the medical department, for physical examination to go on active duty, and if satisfactory, to report to active duty at the Navy Department, Washington, D.C. on November 3rd, 1941. Now I say, well, why on November 3rd? Why not November 1st? Well, November 3rd, because November 1st was on Saturday. Second was the Sunday, so that was a good day. So, from a college teacher, I became a naval officer, just like that, a land-level sailor.
Still a month before
But this will bring us back to some of the other things in which I'm interested. This is strictly a personal thing, but for me. The reason they wanted me, you say, my order is to report to the Navy Department in Washington. And when I got there, I discovered that they had another set of orders to go on to England to learn about radar.
I was about to ask you, I bet this had to do with radar.
Well, but before I got there, somebody said, oh, wait a minute. This man already knows about radar. There's no point in sending him to England. Let's assign him to Bureau of Ships and put him in charge of the training for this electronic programs. And as soon as some of the equipment is brought over here, then, of course, the students or the schools then will go and take a look at the actual equipment. So that was it. Now, how in the world did I learn about radar? At the University of Florida. We didn't call it radar. We call it pulsing. And what were we pulsing? We were pulsing the ionosphere in order to find out how the various layers varied, you know, with the day and night and around the year. And this continues, you know, it's been going on for year still goes on by Bureau standards. The present laboratories, main laboratories, are in Boulder, Colorado. Mm-hmm. But we became interested in that thing here as a result of the original research which was done here on atmospherics, or usually called now spherics.
And that is the noise that we get from thunderstorms and other activities in the skies. And the way it came about is because in England, Professor Watson Watt has developed a device, radiogoniometer, a device, radio direction finder, to find the direction from which lightning noise or lightning atmospherics arriving. And the Navy Department research, Naval Research, had gotten interested that they had obtained two sets of the equipment. And Professor Weil, being a very astute man, got them all at one set. And the reason he wanted it, because he thought that if we can tell where the atmospherics are coming from, we can start by telling what the storm is and what storm they were interested in. Hurricanes. See? So this became the Hurricane Research Project. Well, and we carried out work, unfortunately. Some of the research, you wind up with a result, but it's not the result that you want. In other words, we proved something, but this is not what we wanted to prove. Right. And what we proved, of course, was the static didn't come from the center of the hurricane, and that's the only way you can locate it, because the hurricane has a diameter about anywhere from 250 to 500 miles. Well, the noise of the static comes from what they call the right first quadrant, which is right front quadrant. The storm was like this quadrant here. So we found that out. Now we published papers published by the proceedings of the Institute of Radio Engineers. So, you know, they were scholarly papers based on research. But in the process, we got interested in doing, helping out the Bureau of Standards and the Carnegie Institution in sounding the ionosphere. Mm-hmm. And the way you sound it, you send short bursts of radio energy, and it go up there and bounce it back, reflects. And then you measure the time that it goes up and comes down. This, of course, is measured electronically. So in order to do that, we have to build, incidentally, we have to build all our equipment from parts that were salvaged from the WPA radio project that Jordan had. And they had one going in Jacksonville that followed it up. So we inherited some of the actual very expensive, very good receivers and some, well, they're not very good transmitters they tried to build, but anyway, we got the parts and we built a lot of good. So we're trying to get a better pulsar for the ionosphere. And I did. We didn't have any patent agreements with the university. I probably could have made $1 million. But I didn't know any better, you see.
Mm-hmm. Well, you wouldn't
it could have been another Gatorade. But I didn't know any better, and I don't think even a patent attorney would have known any better. We're so excited because we have built the first purely electronic pulsing equipment.
Well, you could never know that.
So we are so excited, you see, we wanted the rest of the world to know about it. So I wrote a paper describing it, see? And in the paper, it says, that's never been done this way before, and it should be a grave improvement for the equipment, but application is limited because the people will be who are interested, the people like us who are interested in atmospheric research.
never foresee the military.
Well, I didn't know anything about radar. Nobody told me, you see. Well, anyway, as soon as we publish, of course, that's it. It's in public domain. But Visit May, it worked out all right. One of the kids that did some of the legwork. I never wrote a paper and said it has to be social. There is no professor who has written anything or done anything without help from students, assistants, or whatever. In many instances, it's really their work instead of his. But I have always felt that the people that need more encouragement and more credit is the young fellows. So I always included students in the case may be. So this young fellow was included. So anyway, we submitted to Electronics Magazine for publication, and they paid us $50. So all prop got raised. $50. Well, anyway, there it was, except for the larger power, you see. There was the radar principle. I mean, we had it. Of course, other people who were developing larger and slightly different vacuum devices or tubes, but that's natural when you discover a principle and you can always develop the tools. Now, the principle was originally discovered by the Naval Research Laboratory in Anacostia, just outside Washington. And the way they discovered, they are transmitting, and all of a sudden they noticed that there in the line they had these echoes. And somebody said, oh, wait a minute, there's something funny going on. We don't get this thing unless there's a boat going up the river.
Lasers.
So some work was started here, and the fellow that originated this other equipment for the atmospheric research, Watson Watt, then picked up the idea and developed radar. So he became Sir Watson Watt.
Just in time for the Battle
and
of Britain.
Just in time for the Battle of Britain to save Britain from the lookout. Yeah.
So you stayed in the United States mostly during the war, I guess, or all during the war?
Oh, yes. I stayed. I was in Washington. I set up all the electronic schools. Now, the Navy had what they call the Radio Material School, which was located at the Naval Research Laboratory outside Washington. And it was really a school for training petty officers in electronics. The lower grades, I mean the apprentices were simply kids who were drafted or joined the service, and then they learned by observing the first class and chiefs and so on.
Can you work with sonar? So forth during the war?
Was developed. Of course, I furnished the equipment for the sonar scopes too eventually, but it was pretty much a separate operation. Sonar was not anything new. I mean, we had it. It was really the same principle, but different frequencies. Mm-hmm. And so we set up schools and the thing just exploded. I mean, this entire training business exploded because first they said, well, we should train about a couple of hundred of these people. Well, when I got there in the bureau ships and I looked at plans with the ships in service, in commission, and ships being built,
and how many? And also, of course, the equipment that was coming on. How much? How many units? How large a ship? I mean, how many units go on a battleship and an aircraft carrier? So, other things. So I said we need at least 5,000 to 8,000 men. And the Bureau of Naval Personnel thought I was nuts. I said, well, this is arithmetic. So many battleships, so many cruisers, so many corvettes, so many destroyers, so many aircraft carriers, so much equipment. How many men are you going to put on? I said, do you know it takes 30 technicians to service electronic equipment on the battleship?
Gun direction,
yeah,
radar, and so forth.
But I was very fortunate. As I say, in my life, I've been very fortunate. I was very fortunate in this. Maybe I had some crazy ideas, but always got enough brass backing to get away with it. And in those days, I ran into this young officer who was attached to just being formed the Office of Naval Research, not the Naval Research Observatory, but the Office of Naval Research, which is both operational and development. And so he said, well, Commander, I think I'll take you to meet Admiral Fuhrer. I said, fine. So I met Admiral Fuhrer. And I just, in my life, I've been fortunate to meet really outstanding people. And that is like a lot. Mm-hmm. So Admiral Fuhrer apparently was impressed, and we are in the same building. And then he said, well, I'd like you to meet Admiral Lee. Admiral Lee was Assistant Chief of Naval Operation Readiness, which meant that he was the man to see the ships and planes and everything ready to go wherever they were. They had everything they needed and so on.
I see.
So with their backing, we kept on setting up this various schools, and I think at the end of the war, I think we had something like almost 3,000 men in the school.